And these are the folks on our panel. So our first talk after my opening remarks is going to be by Dr. Harshad Sanghvi, who's Vice President and Medical Director of JAPIGO. That's the Johns Hopkins Program in International Obstetrics and Gynecology. Our newest colleague, Beth Payne, at the University of British Columbia. She'll talk about the new Gates-funded project dealing with the second leading cause of maternal mortality globally. To be followed by Sue Ellen Miller. Dr. Miller is right here at the University of California in San Francisco. He's professor of OBGYN and has been working on a unique technology to save lives in women. My colleague on the far right, Dr. Shiva Gowder. I've been working with Dr. Gowder now for 12 or 13 years. I've just left India, in fact, with his team, and we have a combined program, NIH-funded, in the Global Network for Women's Health and Women and Children's Health, looking at research to go ahead and affect outcomes. And finally, no surprise to any of you, having Dr. Potts here in San Francisco would absolutely be a requirement. We look to him for vision and for leadership. He's the Bigsby Chair at the School of Public Health, and Malcolm and I have been working together now, I guess, 42 years now. It's been a long time. So with that, let's begin. I have no financial interest to disclose. And last year when I gave this talk, opening remarks, I was talking about how far behind we were in addressing some of the maternal child health needs. So I'm going to flip-flop it a little bit, I think it's a suggestion of you, Harshad, and talk a little bit about, you know, how far we've come. So in 1990, we had 550,000 maternal deaths. In 2010, that number is down to 287. That's a major, major change, and we need to take a look and be proud of the changes we've made, even as we recognize that we have a long way to go. So I remember when I first began looking at these numbers, the differential about 25 years ago between the developed and the developing world was about 100 to 1. Then we were so proud it went down to 50 to 1. And now it's down to 15 to 1. So we're getting closer, we're getting closer. Yet 56% of all of the deaths remain in sub-Saharan Africa and one-third in South Asia. So we put it together, it's more than 85% of the deaths in two areas of the world. And that's the reason why many organizations are focusing on these two areas to try to impact MDG 5 goals. So a few success stories. Can it be done? So in terms of sub-Saharan Africa's maternal death rate, it's down 41% in 20 years. We always hear about the terrible stories going on there, and there are some tough ones. But we've moved from 850, the maternal mortality ratio, 850 deaths per 100,000 live births, down to about 500. We still have a long way to go. But if we look at Equatorial Guinea, 1 in 10 countries worldwide that's already reached MDG 5 goals, meaning able to reduce maternal mortality by 75%, before 2015, they've reduced the maternal mortality from 1,200 to 240, 100,000 live births. Stories, we need to learn what these countries have done, and we need to go ahead and embellish those changes as we move forward. Eritrea is among one of the 9 countries on track to achieve MDG goal 5, 880 down to 240. With the average decline of 6.3% a year. So you need to average about a 5.1, 5.2, 5.5% a year to get to where you want to go. In fact, 24 of the 46 sub-Saharan African countries have achieved a reduction of over 41% in maternal deaths since 1990. So these are some of the countries it's worth looking at. It's not only small countries. Ethiopia, a rather large country, 64% reduction. Rwanda, 63%. Angola, misspelled. Madagascar, 62%. Cape Verde. And everybody likes to focus in on Nigeria. Even Nigeria, which is has the second highest burden in maternal death worldwide after India. So if you take a look, 14% of the global deaths are in Nigeria, one of the reasons why Gates is focusing on that. There's been a 41% reduction in maternal mortality. So again, good news story. I told you I just returned from India, and I gave a talk at the sort of ACOG of India recently, and sort of shared with the audience what's been happening in India over time. And it's really a great news story. Take a look at 1990, 570,000 per 100,000 live births, the mortality ratio. And just follow that number down to 230, and now it's considerably lower than that in the last data that's been accumulated. On the other hand, there are still problems. Because of the size of the population, India leads all countries in maternal mortality, about 19% of all mortality. And there are really, really large differences depending on where you go in India. So I'll show you one slide about the south of India, which is doing exceptionally well. And we also recognize that anemia is sort of a co-founder. 50% of everybody has a significant anemia. And part of it is because of diet, part of it is nutrition, part of it is poverty, part of it is micronutrients, part of it is the whole process where people have their family very, very quickly, so there's no opportunity for spacing and the opportunity of regaining hemoglobin levels. A lot of issues that need to be addressed. So these are Tamil Nadu, Kerala, Goa, Karnataka, four states in the south, and they will reach MDG goals. And these four states, each one represents in size a country, but when you put them together, it's pretty massive. What do we learn from this? Reasonably strong economic growth, an emphasis on education, and including education of young girls, which is very, very important, an increase in facilities birth, and we can talk about the pros and cons. Not all facilities are up to the task yet, but I think it's a step in the right direction. And the initiation, our site did this first, of household surveys so that you can have good data and determine whether or not what you're doing is really real. So why do women die? If we look at the overview, we used to say that 25% of all deaths are due to postpartum hemorrhage. In fact, it's much more than that. It's 35%, and I've heard some reports much higher than that as we've addressed some of the other issues. So severe bleeding, average time of death from the time of bleeding, about 2 hours. We're going to hear a presentation on the second leading cause of maternal death, eclampsia and elevated blood pressure in pregnancy. Infections usually manifest during and especially postpartum. And I'm going to say a word about unsafe abortion because we never, ever spend time addressing this, and we need to do that. And remember that HIV/AIDS, about 10% of all of the maternal mortality in Africa, and malaria, AIDS, and TB, while actually going down, are really cofactors in lots of maternal deaths. So we need to be concerned. So a good news story. This is the article that we published in The Lancet back in 2006, showing that if you can give women misoprostol, you can reduce their risk of postpartum hemorrhage rather dramatically. And the number needed to treat was only 18 to go ahead and get an effect in terms of postpartum hemorrhage. So you'll hear more from our panelists in terms of how far this has spread, but it's nice to know that WHO has taken it up, and this is now in the essential medicines list. This is good. Hypertension in pregnancy, always knew it was a problem, 11% of all first pregnancies, but until you could actually find a mechanism, and you'll see one today, for easy screening and being able to go ahead and effectively treat and transfer, we're not going to go ahead and affect outcomes. So we'll hear more about that today as well. And I'm going to spend just a minute on induced abortion because it's really an important area to focus on. 42 million abortions worldwide, about half of them conducted safely and about half of them not conducted safely. And not surprising, the highest rate of unsafe abortion is where we see restrictive laws, which is somewhere between a third and a half of the entire population. But it's interesting that a woman's likelihood to have an abortion has little to do with where she lives, little to do with the rules. If she is compelled to go ahead and terminate a pregnancy, she is going to move forward and do that. And if you take a look at high maternal mortality rates in sub-Saharan Africa, and let's say compare it to India, where those rates are much lower, and this is true across the board, it doesn't matter. The maternal rate from unsafe abortion across every report is between 11 and 14%. So there are common denominators. Part of it is an absence of post-abortion care and screening. It's a great opportunity for us to go ahead and step in. And we also have some possibilities looking at medical abortion, like misoprostol and mifepristone, maybe to go ahead and reduce that risk of sepsis and mortality. So minimum requirements. I think we finally, the light has gone on. I think we've known this for some time. You always hear, we know what to do to prevent deaths. We need to make misoprostol and or oxytocin readily available for both prevention and treatment. Really, really necessary. We need to screen and treat hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. We need to address sepsis early, so there needs to be injectable antibiotics. These are low cost, shouldn't be a problem. We need to provide post-abortion and postpartum follow-up with effective contraception. And you'll be hearing in just a moment an increase in access to long-term contraceptive methods. So women should really be given a choice in what they want to use. A lot of it is culturally dependent, and we need to go ahead and do that. And then, of course, what good is transferring if you can't do a C-section or you can't deliver a patient and there's no blood availability? So minimally, for every 500,000 population, you need one facility that's able to do a cesarean section safely, with anesthesia, with pediatrics, with resuscitation. That's really an important component. So I'm going to end my remarks before turning it over to Dr. Sanghvi by just talking about community health workers. You know, there's been a great debate among us, and I think most of us on the panel were very upset with the move of WHO to only skilled birth attendants. Because while that's a good thing to do, we recognize that you could not integrate skilled birth attendants at the speed that WHO had hoped to do. So there are 60 million births still out of the healthcare facilities right now, 52 million without assistance of skilled birth attendants. And in those cases, traditional birth attendants actually are there 75% of the time. So you can't sort of just negate them and sweep them out. And WHO assumed that by the year 2015, there would be 90% skilled birth attendants. That number has now been downtrending to about 65%. We've gone from 55 to 65%. And while in India, they've been able to go in and have the resources for moving away from traditional birth attendants, this is not the case in most of Africa and many other parts of the world. So since we're talking about research, if we take a look at a meta-analysis or a systematic review of what we've learned, when you train these community health workers, you can reduce mortality, overall neonatal perinatal mortality, by about a quarter. Very, very meaningful. And this is true with the observational studies as well. And the good news story is we're going to see a technical consultation report coming out of WHO that basically is saying, okay, it's time to bring the community health workers back into the fold. We were sort of waiting to hear this. All methods of non-surgical contraception they'll be able to do, and it's my understanding from the recent meeting in Rome that they will be involved in active distribution of misoprostol for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage, obviously with training. It wouldn't have happened without real commitment from folks on the panel and many of you in the audience, and we're very, very excited about what has evolved. So with that, I'm going to turn the podium over to Dr. Sanghvi.